Hey everyone, this is Rich. Sorry to interrupt the beginning of the show, I know you want to get to it, but I've got to tell you that we've now got new t-shirts available in our store. We've got a store back again. Just go to simplysyndicated.com/store and you can get the new t-shirt design that we've had done. It looks incredible, so go and check that out now. And if you're a Simply Everything subscriber, there's a special store just for you people where you can get everything even cheaper. And don't forget, if you sign up to Simply Everything now, you get a week's free trial and you can hear all the stuff we've done in the past, all the previous episodes of Movies You Should See, all the new episodes of Make It So and Shaken Not Stirred as well. There's lots of premium content there just for you subscribers. So go and visit simplysyndicated.com/everything and you'll see a page that tells you all about it. Okay, enjoy the show. Right, hello everybody, welcome to Movies You Should See. Today we are discussing the sci-fi classic from, and I must be very clear about this, from 1951, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Not the 2008 Keanu Reeves, Jennifer Connelly one, which is...
Oh shit, I rushed one. Oh.
Which is, yeah, which is awful. We've got a wonderful panel of people together today. We have, of course, got Admiral Marius Salosa.
Good evening.
Welcome to Movies You Should See. This
Thank
is your
you.
Pick as well, isn't it?
It was, yeah.
It's a good one.
I love this movie.
And Scott did so well before, we thought we'd have him back. Hi, Scott.
Oh, hello, I've come to visit you in peace and with goodwill.
It's good to have you back. And we've got the new boy with us today, who it's a pleasure to have you on board. So, Matt Zupka's with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Looking awesome. Forward to this.
It's going to be good. So, The Day the Earth Stood Still. I was looking over the cast list, and I think this might be, without doing any research into it, this is one where there's actually a main actor in a film that was not born in the same century as any of us. Looking at Sam Jaff, born in 1891.
Oh, wow.
Who, of course, is Professor Barnard. I'm not saying that correctly.
The Einstein analog.
Yes.
Right.
There's too many letters in that name for my English brain to deal with it. So let's kick things off. And Rick, seeing as you brought this one to the table, why don't you start with your summary of The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Okay. You know, it's kind of funny because when I remember this film, which I've seen several times, it doesn't feel like a whole lot happens. Spaceship lands in Washington, D.C., flying saucer, and guy comes out in a funny-looking helmet, says, I come in peace, holds out a little doodad, and the little doodad opens up, and a jittery soldier shoots him. Then this big, scary robot comes out and fries all the weapons, and then they take alien dude to the hospital. He wants to see the president. They won't let him see the president. He gets out of the hospital, wanders around Earth for a while, scares the hell out of the populace, talks to scientists. Then at the end, he says, we're not worrying about spoiling a 50-year-old movie, right?
No, I think we can spoil this film.
Okay.
Yeah.
He says, okay, well, the reason I came here is because y'all are dangerous, and your dangerousness is getting ready to leave the planet, and we're not going to let you do that. So either knock off the nuclear shit, or we're going to fry this planet, and then he flies away. That's kind of it, but it's done really well.
Okay. Awesome. Scott, do you want to go next?
That's everything that the Admiral just said, and that's it. he really summed it up.
He's
pretty well. It's hard to top it. Now, the version that I saw, not like it's some kind of special version, but what the copy that I acquired was a transfer from the Blu-ray. So when I sat down to watch it last night for the first time ever, I was really impressed with how good it looked. I obviously the special effects were from 1950-51, and they hold up well considering how old they are. But just the filming itself, the picture quality and the lighting, it looked really, really good. I would not have pegged it for a 1951 film if I didn't know it already. So on top of it looking great, the story, which has just been neatly outlined for us, like you said, Admiral, not a whole lot really happens, but it is done really well. I didn't find myself bored throughout the film because what little calm action that they have is presented nicely paced and I thought well written. So it keeps the viewer moving along with it without us wanting things to hurry up, especially now in 2013 when we are used to no single shot lasting more than, what is it now, 3 seconds?
Oh, is it that long?
I assume they were just measuring it in frames. It was that short now. Let's not even bother with time anymore. It's so many frames.
It's getting there. It's getting there. I found myself thinking, when I was watching it last night, I was thinking back to the most recent episode of Starbase 66, where Unk was talking about, I can't remember the name of the book that he was discussing, that had the formula for modern movies. I kept thinking about that a lot, wondering how this would measure up to that movie recipe that he was describing.
I don't remember the name either. Sorry. I don't listen to the show. I just record it.
That's my excuse.
As I feel like I have the name of that book on the tip of my tongue, but yeah, you're right. How would this bear up to the today's formulaic writing?
I don't think it would. I don't. It doesn't follow the formula, which is one of the reasons I love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, do you want to add anything in a kind of summary of your opinion to this, or should we just get straight down to it? Whatever you like.
I'll do a quick summary of my experience. After panicking and thinking I was going to have to duck out on this because I'd only seen the 2008 movie version. I remembered I live in the future, so I was able to get a copy of it. And I liked it. I have this hurdle where people are like, oh my God, this movie is so great. And then I watch it, I'm kind of like, heh? And this was kind of like that. I mean, it was definitely good. But yeah, I mean, pretty much Scott and the Admiral have walked into my head, taken out my thoughts, and said them before I could get them out, as far as a summary goes.
I kind of think, well, I'll carry us on then, because I here's a proposition for you all. I think this is one of those films that, and I too felt bad that I hadn't seen this yet, because I kind of feel that you can't be a proper certified hardcore sci-fi fan, or in fact a big movie fan, and not have seen this film. That this
exactly.
This is a very famous, kind of influential film. I think you'll see this film referenced a lot and referred to a lot in other things. And I don't know, it's kind of like, if you're a big music fan, you can't just like one genre of music, and maybe you've got to have a jazz album in your collection somewhere, even if you're not a big jazz fan, and that sort of thing. You've got to have seen this film. And I always felt very bad that I hadn't, so I'm glad that I got the chance to see it for this.
Well, the thing that the caveat that I'd like to put out there with this film is, and it's a problem I have with a lot of shows and films from this era, is that the cliches that fill this movie, when you see it, if you're coming at it from the standpoint of someone, you know, born in the 70s or 80s or 90s, it's like one cliche after another. But this is where they started. This is the
right
film that wrote that created the template that got copied so many times in the ensuing 4 decades that every time you see something, you're like, oh, I've seen that a dozen times. You've got to remember, this is where it began. This is what people are ripping off. And you have to keep reminding yourself that through the mill. And I don't think it's that hard to remind yourself of that. I don't think there's anything in this film that is... Well, all right. The ending, the message at the end is pretty blunt, but that's kind of the whole point of the film. I don't think it hammers you over the head with, you know, ooh, this is a spooky, scary alien movie kind of thing. I think it's one of the things that that Robert Wise, who was the director, and what's his name, Julian, what's the producer's, Julian Blaustein, were really going for was realism. They wanted this film taken seriously, which up until this point, science fiction films hadn't been. And shortly after this film was made, they will stop being taken seriously again. But one of the reasons this movie endures to this day, and one of the reasons it's rightfully a classic, is because they played it totally seriously. They did not play it for laughs. They didn't play it for camp. Everybody was deadly serious in the film. That doesn't make it boring, though. It just makes it real. And I think that's why it endures so well.
I do find it interesting right. that this came from the guy who also gave us Star Trek the Motion Picture. And you sort of think, well, that's one occasion where maybe not taking it so seriously might have been a better idea.
I think you misspoke there, Richard. Don't you mean the Motionless Picture?
Yes. Ooh. Sorry, yes.
The Motionless Picture. Get that subtitle.
Right. Yeah. And another film that has to be part of my collection, but it's still got the cellophane on. I think that's what sums it up. It's there. It's next to Wrath of Khan, but it's never been put in the machine.
Might I suggest you open it and watch it with the director's commentary on?
Oh, yeah.
If you listen to Robert Wise talk about making the film, you will watch it with much more charity.
Hmm.
Because the obstacles he had to get over to get that film even out in theaters were so staggering. It's amazing it's as good as it is. And I'll just leave that there.
And if I may just add one thing to the Motionless Picture, relatives of mine were just watching it, and I just found a new way to describe the motion picture: enterprise porn.
Yeah, yes. That's a good way of looking at it.
You know, so yeah, it's the Motionless Picture, but in Admiral, you've said it before: those opening shots of the Enterprise, that's worth the price of admission.
Oh yeah, I'll watch that launching from space dock scene over and over and over again. But we're
in
not
the dark with a blanket.
I plead the fifth.
You guys made it a dirty thing.
Right.
So Rich, I got a question for you.
Syndicated.
Go ahead, Rick. What's your question?
At the beginning of the movie, when Klaatu's ship is coming in.
Yes.
And you've got this, they're going all over the world, and just something is coming into the atmosphere at 4,000 miles an hour. Now, this was 1951. And they were showing like news reports from all over the world. And in one news report, the news report from Britain, said that they were getting reports from all over the Empire. Were they still calling it the Empire in 1951?
No, possibly
because
we we'd gone through World War II, and that was kind of what I take to be our. Because, of course, I've never been alive in a time where we've legitimately referred to the Empire. At most, we get the Commonwealth, which is a slightly less aggressive way of saying the Empire, because it's just countries that used to be in the Empire, and the ones that don't hate us so much that they don't want to acknowledge it anymore. But in 1951, I think, because once you get to the end of World War II, and we'd just spent so long fighting the Germans building their empire, it was kind of embarrassing that we still had one. And so it was kind of a case of giving it all up, except the Falkland Islands, because we want to argue about that one later. I don't know that we'd have said that in 1951, to be perfectly honest. I don't think we would have done.
Okay, because I kind of get there's a couple of times where British people are shown. And there was that, and there was another one where some guy in the street with a really horrible accent says, like, oh my, or something. I don't even know what it was, but it struck me as being very, very bad. And I was just wondering if that stood out to you at all.
Oh, no, we did speak like that generally then, I think. I was just having this discussion with Alison, actually, about we've just done a Shaken Not Stirred on From Russia With Love, which was 1963. I think, and, you know, she was laughing quite a lot of the way through with, especially when Q comes into the office and he's talking about this briefcase with the things here and here, and people don't talk like that, and I think they did in 1963. He's a British gent, of course he speaks like that and says, yeah, instead of here. And so, yeah, that's...
And apparently if you're from outside of DC, you have a New England accent. That's yeah. Like, I heard that line. I'm just like, what? No.
I had to laugh because I'm from New England.
Right.
Yeah, I don't talk like... You know what amazes me about Michael Rennie is that he was 35 in that film.
Was he really?
Does he look 35?
God, no.
No.
God, no. And I did think that when they guessed his age to be 35 to 38. And I looked at him and thought, well, I'm 34. And if you're 35, you aren't looking well for it, mate. You know, but no, he was 35. And I see from Bradford, which is pretty much where I'm sat right now.
Yeah. You want to hear a bit of trivia, casting trivia about this movie. Claude Rains very nearly played Klaatu.
Right.
They wanted him for the role, and he was doing a play in New York and couldn't get out of it. And so the role went to Michael Rennie.
He did well with it.
He did.
I was quite impressed, not just with his Pete Postlethwaite-like cheekbones, but with the entirety of the performance. I thought he did really well.
Same here. And one of the things I liked, especially when they were sitting at the breakfast table of the rooming house, every time they started talking about the alien, he just got this look of bemusement. Like, I've got a secret. And I loved that. Was probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, was that smirk, because it was just like, you know, we're all in on the secret. He's just sitting there going, if you guys only knew.
Yeah.
I kind of took it as, aren't you cute?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those things are so adorable.
Bless you.
Little humans.
Yeah.
I was taken out of that scene just a little bit, being distracted by the presence of Aunt B.
Yeah.
In the boarding house. But I got over there pretty quickly.
Distracted by Judd Hirsch.
Rich is the oh hell.
The Andy Griffith Show.
It is the Andy Griffith Show. At all, anything on your radar?
No.
Okay. Do y'all know who Andy Griffith is? Matlock.
I'm familiar with Andy Griffith, and am I right in thinking that Richie Cunningham used to be on that show?
Yes, yes. He played Andy Griffith's son, but they lived with their Aunt B, who was the not the woman who ran the boarding house, but the one who was always bitching at her husband.
Oh,
when they were playing cards,
the one who thought that the alien ship was a Soviet trick.
That wasn't thinly veiled or anything.
No.
No.
Damn Soviets. I don't know. See, I missed all of that stuff as well. I don't know that that was ever that much of a big deal. This is all stuff I must ask my dad about. Because it's culturally, this is far beyond me. And would be far more relevant to my dad, who was born the year before this came out.
Okay.
So he'd have much better knowledge about this than me, in terms of stuff like that. I will ask him actually about that Empire thing when I speak to him next and find out, because I might be totally wrong. But maybe we still had a bit of an Empire. I don't know. We just have bits that we own everywhere, and it still pisses people off. I mean, we're doing it now. Have you guys had any news about what's going on in Gibraltar?
No,
because you see, we own Gibraltar, right? And it's essentially just a big rock off the coast of Spain. And it's one of those places that you look at it on a map and you think, why have we got, what is that to do with us? And the Spanish sit there thinking exactly the same thing. And at the moment, they're kicking up again, as they do every 10 years or so, making it difficult for English people to go on and off Gibraltar, going, really, it should be ours, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but it's ours. Get off it. And it's just part of what we do every so often. I don't know. Everyone's kicking up at the moment. The Argentinians are having a go at the Falklands again. It would be better had we just totally given up everything when we had the chance to do so. I still can't get over the fact that they thought Michael Rennie was 35. Or that he was 35.
But he was? Yeah, well, when I listened to the director's commentary, Robert Wise was talking about this young man, Michael Rennie, walked in. And I'm like, dude, he's got to be in his 50s. And he's like, no, 35. Like, wow, we are much younger now than our parents were at our age.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing, yeah.
But I've always thought that, though, when you see sort of old news reports, you see babies that look older than I am now. You know? It's just the way things have changed. You really do. And so I put it down to that. But then again, still, even for 51, I think he looks old for a 35-year-old.
Yeah. He was a great choice, though. He had enough of an otherworldly look, but you know, you still didn't disbelieve him blending in with everybody else.
That's how I describe a lot of people from Bradford.
You know, something else interesting that Robert Wise mentioned is that he had the what I didn't realize was that color film was an option at this time. It just wasn't the norm, and he preferred using black and white for this film, and I think it really works, especially the way they use, you know, when he, like, the first time we see him in the boarding house with the silhouette and the shadows and stuff. Whoever the director of photography was, I could look it up, but it won't matter, was just brilliant.
Well, I mean, don't forget, color took a long time to sort of be accepted by the public.
Yeah.
It wasn't a case of, hey, we've invented color, now everything's in color. And there were, you know, color had been around in various forms for a long time beforehand. Granted, some of them were a bit crappy, but there
was... Wizard of Oz was 47, 48?
Yeah.
Or am I getting my... Yeah, okay.
Something like that, off the top of my head.
Leo Tover is the DP on this one.
Oh, and I had looked it up, Admiral. I was going to swoop in with the save on that one.
Oh. Okay. I was wrong with Wizard of Oz. It was 39, so even earlier.
Yeah. But even that, I remember when we did a show on that, of us saying, you know, was this the first film in color? And looking it up and finding out, no, far from being the first film in color. It was just one that we remember because of that big change sort of 10 minutes into the film. And we don't really know when color came out. And because we it's so ingrained in our psyche now that things are in color, you just can't imagine that you wouldn't do that if you could. But clearly that was the case.
Black and white definitely adds to the atmosphere of movies. I mean, you know, a good example is the movie Run Silent, Run Deep. I don't think that movie would be the same in color. You know, and it's one of my favorite submarine movies of all time.
Mm. There are a number of films like that. And I think, you know, just to be the only person ever to mention Young Frankenstein and Schindler's List in the same sentence. they're two great examples of that. Films that could absolutely have been in color, with no question, and weren't, and were better off to not be.
Oh, yeah. Well, have you ever seen any production stills from Young Frankenstein that are color pictures?
Yes.
It just looks wrong.
It does, absolutely. It's a weird, weird thing. It really is. And I think you have to... From a technical standpoint, I think it means you have to change the way you light things, your makeup effects, things like that, just to make them appear to be more real in black and white. You know, I mean, the best example of that I can think of is Hitchcock wouldn't use fake blood, because fake blood didn't look like blood in black and white. He used chocolate syrup, because had a much better color to it when you were shooting in black and white. And so I think when you do see people who were in black and white films in makeup, they look weird, but it's to look right in black and white. Who else is in this film? Patricia Neal. I hated her. I thought she was by far the worst thing in this film. By a long shot. I thought she was a terrible, terrible actress. I don't know if I'm way off on that.
I looked up in the trivia for this movie on IMDb, and Rick, you probably know where I'm going with this.
Coffee?
What's that?
Coffee? No, never mind. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. she, according to, I think it was an interview that she gave, she did not expect this movie to be good at all. She thought this was just going to be added to the pile of horrible science fiction films that were coming out around that time. So I think the way it was worded in the trivia is she had a difficult time delivering any of her dialogue with a straight face because she didn't expect this to go on to be a success.
I saw an interview with her, and she copped that. She said she was driving everybody crazy, especially Rennie and Wise, because she just kept laughing. And she said at one point, or at several points, Michael Rennie would ask her, do you intend to laugh at this point, you know, in the actual take? And she said she never laughed during the take, but during rehearsal and setting up and stuff, she just didn't take it seriously.
But I've heard Mark Hamill say the same thing about being in Star Wars. That they were doing this and had no idea. Are we supposed to take this seriously? I'm supposed to talk to this robot and have a conversation, and it's a serious conversation. Are you sure about this, George? Because I feel like a bit of a moron here. And they just didn't know what to do, because there was no frame of reference for them. And the idea of doing it and taking it damn seriously was just quite alien, for want of a better phrase, to them.
Yeah.
Well, Harrison Ford, I think, put it best when he said, you can write this dialogue, you can't say it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And what I was getting at with the coffee thing is, when I was growing up, and I don't know if Matt, I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember this. Patricia Neal was the kind of the spokesman for Maxwell House Coffee. And she did a whole, I think it's Maxwell House, might have been Chock Full of, I don't know, it doesn't matter. I knew her as the star of a whole bunch of coffee commercials from when I was a kid in the 70s. So it took me a while to get used to seeing her as a young woman in something other than a coffee commercial anyway. I wrote down in my notes, Patricia Neal does Worried really well, because that's about the only look expression she had on her face through the whole film.
She's not worried about her son, though.
No.
I saw those tweets from you.
Of course, yeah, man, I've just met. You can spend the day with my son, that's fine. I'm going off with my boyfriend. Bye. Have fun.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing when I was watching the movie. I was like, this wouldn't fly in today's age.
Why today's age is the way it is.
Yeah. Right. Today it wouldn't work. However, I found myself wondering as I was watching it last night, is this just something that the screenwriter thought would fly and be okay and get the story moving along? Or was that sort of thing acceptable and common back then, to trust someone that much so quickly to leave your son with him?
And not even a man who you know, who has a family, who lives in a fixed residence. He's just some guy. And he's ever so excited about spending the day with this kid. It would raise a few eyebrows, wouldn't it? I mean, surely even in 1951. And it actually caused me to question, you know, is child abuse a recent thing? Or is it now that we just know that it happens a lot more? And we're much more prepared to talk about it. I can't imagine that it's only happened in the last sort of 20 years. It must have been, you know, awful things must have happened to kids in the 50s too, and even earlier.
I might have to take that scene from the movie and then cut it in with some shots of Chris Hansen from To Catch a Predator.
Klaatu, just have a seat over there, please.
I've got to see this show, because I hear so much about it. And we just don't have anything like this over here. Mind you, we sent you Jeremy Kyle, and well, I'm sorry about that. By the way, let me just officially apologize on behalf of Great Britain. I'm sorry for Jeremy Kyle, America. Whatever you've ever done, you don't deserve that. What else do we have with the day the Earth stood still?
I had a couple of points. One, going back to the beginning of the movie. Did anyone else notice when everybody was running away, they kind of sped the film up a little bit?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, that
and that was just kind of like, because it didn't seem to fit. Like, you know, the saucer coming in was, you know, well done. And I got to admit, the special effects were much better than I was expecting. And then all of a sudden they drew that little high-speed film runaway. And it was just like, okay. And then I was almost looking for it throughout the rest of the film, and they never did it again.
I think it happened once more, just a very slight speed up when the military were running out to their vehicles and taking off to search for Klaatu.
Wow. I may have fallen asleep for about 10 minutes, so maybe that's when it happened.
it was never quite so obvious as that crowd scene. Yeah, that really disappointed me that they did it, but it was so brief that it was easily forgotten.
Right. Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite scenes that I thought was hilarious. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, that's sorry. Go ahead.
I love when they've got Klaatu in the hospital, and you've got the three doctors are sitting out in the room talking about him, and talking about how he's already healed and everything on him is normal, but he's going to live to be 150 years old and stuff, and they're all smoking,
yeah.
talking about how healthy this guy is, and it just.
I was
the
thinking
unintentioned about, but, irony of that scene was genius.
I was thinking about when it was made and wondering, is there going to be a point where Klaatu comes out and just suggests to them that they might not want to do that? But then I thought to myself, no, this is the 50s. I'm sure cigarettes were considered like healthy. They probably had vitamin C in them and stuff. Yes, I stole that quote from Dennis Leary. I wasn't
going to call you on it.
I'm not above shame.
Nothing wrong with that.
One of the things that really impresses me with this movie is the soundtrack, both the soundtrack and the sound effects. When Klaatu's ship comes in, it sounds like a real machine landing, as opposed to just some, you know, kind of thing. It's noisy, it's clunky, it sounds like an actual engine, and I hadn't noticed that before the last time I watched it. Watching it this time, I guess because I was looking at it with a more critical eye for the show, just the fact that they thought to do that impressed the hell out of me.
Absolutely.
I do agree with what you say about the soundtrack and the sound effects. The soundtrack especially, I did like that. Reading after I watched the film, reading that the composer had worked in two differently pitched theremins into the instrumentation. That was really nice. As far as special effects go, I enjoyed when the ship lands in a baseball field.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think. And I was surprised by how good it looked for the ship while it's landing, and you see the people that are still on the field running away from it at the same time. They put that shot together, I thought, very well.
Yeah, well, it was coming down, and there were two people right where it was heading down, and I was like, are they just going to plop it down on there? But they actually got out of the way before it touched down. I was really impressed with that.
Yeah, I noticed the same thing with when the robot's blowing up the tanks and everything like that. It's sort of the motion of people going on behind it that continues. And I did find myself wondering, how did you do that in 1951? Of course, what you do is you get the film of the thing disappearing and overlay it on top of the other film. It's quite obvious now I say it, and I feel rather stupid for questioning myself earlier.
Well, I think we just think that we don't expect any level of sophistication from a film from 1951. And so when we see it, it takes us by surprise.
So I think right. What you can kind of conclude with that is that the better forms of special effects were possible in 1951, but were perhaps required a lot more work and a lot more effort to make them look really good.
Yeah.
You know, as it is now, I could sit here and make some special effects. But in 1951, doing anything passable was a lot of hard work. But in this, no question, they managed it.
Well... One scene that I don't know if people realize was a special effect was Michael Rennie and Billy Gray, who played Little Bobby, were never in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
All of the D.C. stuff was shot by the second unit, and then they were it was composited later. Now, there, I mean, like the picture of the gravestone again in Arlington, that was kind of obviously not there. But I think all of the stuff in the Lincoln Memorial... it didn't feel quite right, but it never rose to the level of me thinking, oh, that's, you know, rear projection or something like that.
Yeah, the Arlington scenes were the only scenes where I kind of went, yeah, there's a green screen behind them. I didn't notice it with, again, you're saying the Lincoln Memorial stuff.
Yeah, they did it ever so well.
Mm-hmm.
Ever so well.
At the Lincoln Memorial, I was on the fence. I was like, I can't tell. I'm going to go ahead and pretend that they were there because it looks close enough for me to just allow myself to believe it. But yes, a few shots were better than others. The Arlington was pretty obvious, and all the scenes in the car or cars, those were pretty clearly done afterward. But
yeah,
for the most part, yeah, they all worked together pretty well. Pretty nicely.
I've actually got it playing right now on the screen in front of me, the Lincoln Memorial bit, and it's really mm-hmm. very good. I think if you look at it knowing that it was composited, you can kind of see it. But yeah, it's really very good, and I think, as Star Wars has shown us, you can clean stuff up too much. Certainly certain bits of the Blu-ray version of Return of the Jedi look awful now. They really do. When Luke's fighting the Rancor monster, it looks horrific now, because they've cleaned it up too much, whereas this looks really very good. And for a film this old, it looks excellent. Really excellent. I kind of wish I'd got the HD version now, which I've rented this from iTunes here.
Yeah, same here.
They did have the HD version available, but I'm too cheap to pay that extra pound for it. I didn't go for it, but yeah, I kind of wish I had now.
I'd like to see it. I have the DVD. I don't have the Blu-ray. I'd like to see it.
It really looks good.
Although there is one scene where I think the better quality works against the film, and that's when Gort is carrying Patricia Neal into the spaceship.
Oh yeah.
Because the problem was that the actor, what's his name, Locke Martin, was 7'6" or 7'7", and then the boots that he wore in the costume raised him up another 6 inches, and the robot's head was about another foot above his. His eyes were right about neck level in that suit, but because he was 7'7", he had probably acromegaly, I think. They just described it as a glandular problem, which is why he was so damn tall. But he was also very, very frail, and so it was all he could do to move in the suit, let alone carry Patricia Neal. So if you
standing see, in the suit,
yeah, oh yeah, there's one scene where Klaatu's giving his final speech where they couldn't. They had two robots. They had the suit for him, and then they had, when it's just standing there being stationary, that's just a suit. There's nobody in it. But because that had squared off feet, had 90 degree feet, when he was standing, Gort had to stand on the rake of the spaceship, the ramp. Martin had to be in the suit for that, and he almost passed out. He couldn't stand there that long for Klaatu's speech. But when he's carrying Patricia Neal, you can see the strings holding her up. And it's one of those moments where you see it, and you go, I don't want to see those, and you try to look away, because at that point you're so invested in the film. But you kind of can't ignore it either. And it's just really quick. It's really brief, but it's still like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
I could stand to see a better remake of this. I really could. I think, you know, I have seen the Keanu version, and it's diabolical. It really is. It's just a god-awful film. But it did kind of... It added one or two elements that I thought, I see why you've added that. It kind of makes sense. I like that he's actually confronted by the scientist, by John Cleese, who basically says, what gives you the right to judge us? You know, what gives you the right to come into a phase of our development as a species and determine that we're not suitable to be around other species? And you kind of think, huh, yeah, actually. And there's none of that in this film, in the original.
Well, it's very clear what their problem is with Earth in this one. Now, I didn't see the new one. You know, as soon as I saw a trailer and saw explosions, I knew I didn't want anything to do with it. It offended me that they remade the film, and I'll admit that I get a little overly emotional about this stuff, but that's why I do a sci-fi podcast. But what is the MacGuffin in the new one? Why does Klaatu come to Earth? It's not because we're a nuclear power anymore, is it?
No, in the new one, they've actually already decided the Earth should be destroyed. They've all that step has already been taken, so it messes things up in that respect. He's not coming as a warning. They've come to destroy the Earth, and you do get a big, massive, really expensive effect sequence of bits of Earth being destroyed, which must have cost a fortune. And so it's If I'd been a big fan of this film when I saw it, I'd have found it really offensive, to be perfectly honest. I would honestly recommend that you never, ever, ever consider watching the new one.
Oh, I would watch The Wild Wild West before I watch the new Day the Earth Stood Still.
Absolutely. And that was, yeah.
And I haven't seen that one either, and I won't, so.
No, don't watch that. I mean, regardless of how you feel about the TV series, just don't watch that film. It's awful. But yeah, the 2008 remake would just offend you, I think. It's a totally different film. But
yeah,
it's annoyingly not different enough. If it was, if they'd really changed a lot around, they might have got away with it. But it's too close to the original, and yet too different from the original. It would just be annoying and offensive, I think. I don't have a good word to say about it. I'm curious about its IMDb score now I'm talking about it. Because this is the original is a 7.9, which is... I'd class that as a really good film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Purely based on its score. The remake is a 5.4. So
it seems high.
I believe it.
I think it seems high, to be perfectly honest. From the director of Hellraiser Inferno. That's not a good sign, is it? No, that's not a good sign. And The Exorcism of Emily Rose, he also did that. Scott Derrickson.
Now, you want to know something funny about that?
Go for
it. My wife's maiden name is Emily Rose.
Right.
So when that movie came out, we thought that was pretty amusing. We never did see it, though.
Oh, it's awful. It's awful. If you remember in early episodes of Mike and Craig making fun of the "don't you believe it" line, that's from that film.
Oh, okay.
It's just terrible. Terrible, terrible film. I'm sure that I've seen some good films. I don't feel like I have now. I'm sat talking about this because every other film I've mentioned I've said is terrible. But not this one. Who else do we have? Tom Marlowe as... Hugh Marlowe, sorry, as Tom Stevens. That's my tired brain.
He gets third billing on the DVD, and I don't understand that, aside from, I guess, in 1951, they didn't dare give a kid top billing, because I think Billy Gray did a hell of a lot more in the film than Hugh Marlowe did.
Yeah.
I agree.
I ended up really hating his character. Especially when he's blowing the whole thing towards the end of, I don't care about the rest of the world. Really? That's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to be in love with a hero.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, he's supposed to go along with it and be on the side of his woman, but no, he's like, to hell with you, I'm going to be in the paper. That's it.
And he figures that being in the paper and getting the recognition is going to make him more desirable, I guess. It's going to ingratiate him to his girlfriend, even though she's kind of telling him flat out, don't do that.
Yeah. I would suggest that there are many ways of being in the newspaper, and most of them involve not being impressive.
Yeah. Now, I would have liked to have seen him be more of a bastard at the beginning of the film. Then Patricia Neal leaving her son with Klaatu would have made a little more sense if she was kind of bullied into it by her boyfriend. And because, you know, he starts off the film seeming like, gee whiz, I'm a great guy. And you know, she does the, I'm worried, I really don't want to leave Bobby with this guy, but I'm going with him. You know, Tom wants to go out. If he had been a little more forceful then, I think we would have seen a better progression of the character.
Right.
To that thing at the end there.
It also would have made it a little bit easier to believe his suspicion and jealousy about why am I can't think of her name. Patricia Neal's character is
Benson. Helen Benson.
Yeah,
Helen. That's right. Helen and Klaatu, you know, they have a conversation. So Tom immediately assumes, oh, they're starting to fall for each other. Well, by golly, we can't have that.
It
seemed very
that-
sudden.
That feels like just that's how life was in the 50s. I don't know. Again, I'm just
way
off.
Possibly. I mean, I was watching the movie and, you know, his character just didn't seem to have a purpose. Like, you probably could have taken his character out and not have lost anything. But then when he's the one who's like, oh, got to turn him into the army. Okay, well, that's his whole reason for being there.
Pretty much. That, yeah. That is it entirely, isn't it? Because he doesn't have anything else to do. I mean, he does the running around town asking people about the diamonds thing. But you could have got another character to do that. Patricia Neal could have done that.
Exactly, and that's what I would have thought it would have been. Would have been her doing it.
Yeah, but no, he was just there for that and to screw things up at the end. Which
right.
would have just pissed her off, I think. Speaking now, of somebody who's screwed up enough of his girlfriend's plans to know exactly how they react to it, it's not a positive thing.
Well, you know, one thing that's nobody has really mentioned, and that is kind of unusual for the time period, is that Patricia Neal's character is a single mother. Now, yes. they never say, you know, gee, this is the widow Benson or anything like that. So there's no obvious her husband's dead. They just never talk about it.
Oh, but she's the good kind of widow, because she didn't leave her husband. He died in a war.
Yeah.
Oh, do they say that? Oh, that's right. The kid says his father died in the war.
Arlington, don't. Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah, so that's right. she's a good kind of widow. She's not a bad widow. She's a good widow. And so I think that's how she gets away with it.
Yeah, I totally forgot that Billy Bobby, whatever the hell his name is, said that.
The only thing I remember Bobby saying is G at the beginning of every sentence out of his mouth.
That's how they talked in the 1950s, isn't it?
I seriously considered spending the first 5 minutes of this podcast starting every sentence with G.
It is. It's that. I'm with you, Matt. I thought that's how they talked in the 50s. Or kind of, oh boy. Oh, gee. Oh, boy.
I mean, yeah. I've seen a couple of, like, 1950s movies of that ilk, and yeah, it's all very much like, you know, golly gee gosh, yay! And it's just like, no!
In fact, when I think of films that weren't made in the 50s but are even set in the 50s, they put that in. I'm thinking of A Christmas Story with the little brother Randy, who's always, oh gee, that's mine! Oh boy, that's mine! And all that kind of thing. I think that's just what kids said.
Right.
I could be way off. I don't know what
these days they just say fuck.
Yeah. What's that? I want that. Give me that. That's mine. Fuck you. Take my Xbox. I'll kill you. Other things like that. That's what kids say now. But they terrorize their neighbors and the like.
One other thing I'd like to ask y'all about to see what you all's opinion is. Yeah, I live in the South. Something that's always bothered me about the movie. And finally got it explained when I saw this documentary about it. At the end, you know, Klaatu gets killed, and then Gort puts him in the microwave, and he comes out, and he's all better. And Helen says, you know, Gort has the power of life and death, and Klaatu says, no, that's reserved for the Almighty Spirit. That was not in the original script.
I was
that
glad.
That was forced on them by the studio.
Yep. Yeah, I was just reading that today.
Mm-hmm. I was really glad to read that because that was the most awkward and out of place line in the entire script.
Yep.
I missed the line. I think it wouldn't have sat well with me had I caught that.
I was desperately hoping there would not be more about that afterward, and luckily there wasn't. So I can just take that one line, erase it from my viewing memory, and then just be totally fine with everything else.
Yeah, that would be horrible. The aliens finally arrive and they're preaching about bloody God. It's like, what have we got to do? Do we just pretend we're not in when the aliens arrive? Is that what we do? Or we just, sorry, we're really busy right now. We haven't got time for this. Sorry, bye.
I was picking up on the Christ allegory, the parallels when Gort put Klaatu in the Easy Bake. and I figured, okay, maybe it's just like a small undercurrent. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe they're not really planning for this. And then he had that line about the Almighty Spirit. I said, oh, please, no, don't ruin it. Don't ruin it. No, no. And they didn't. Okay, happy.
Yeah. Well, I was just reading the Wikipedia here, and talking about the whole Almighty Spirit, there is actually more subliminal, now that I'm reading it, not so subliminal comparisons to Christian religion in this movie. Because you think about it, his name is Carpenter, and then he ascended from dead and rose to the sky.
Oh, God, I never realized
that. Yeah, I saw some of that, too. I think that's kind of pushing it a little
bit. Yeah, I mean, I didn't see it until I, you know, just read, and I was like, oh, yeah. But it wasn't like I noticed it right off the bat. I had to read about it and have it told to me to see that it was there. But it's just like, okay, but it's a movie about aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was one other thing that didn't quite sit right with me, and it was all right as a basic concept, but when you really sat and thought about it, it was quite a horrific thing, which is the half hour he stops all machinery for. And you sort of think, well, you've tried to do something non-destructive, but that's everyone who's in surgery right now is just dead.
Well, no, they say not hospitals, not airplanes in the sky.
Oh, did they? Oh, right. I apologize then. I missed that. Slightly perturbed by the footage of the guys crawling into big machinery to see why it's not working and thinking, well, they're dead when that comes back on, aren't they?
Yeah, I did think of, I hadn't noticed that before, but the guys crawling into the printing presses, like, are so dead in half an hour.
I'll just stick my head in between these cogs and see what's wrong. Oh, dear. It's like checking down the barrel of a gun to see if it's loaded, isn't it? It's, you know, you're waiting for Bugs
Bunny
and Elmer.
Give me that match. I'm going to go see if there's any gas in the tank.
Yeah. It's just like, what are you doing? Don't get in it. It's a machine. Go ahead.
So I got really nervous when his demonstration started with all the electricity going out. That was the only note I ended up taking during the film. Was to write down worldwide power outage that is to be non-destructive is going to kill a ton of people. And then not 5 minutes later, you get, I think it was the general that specifies that hospitals and airplanes and other things of that sort did not lose power. It was a selective power outage. And I said, oh, see, look at that. They fixed it. And I was really impressed that they would catch that sort of thing and make sure that it got just enough of a mention to pass the logic test.
Yeah,
something that's always bugged me about this film, and again, there's this documentary that's on this copy that I've got, the Studio Classics version. That if you like the movie, I really suggest you watch it. It's mostly Robert Wise and Julian Blaustein. Blaustein's kind of scary to look at. He's about 8,000 years old and looks it. But they tell some great stories about this. And the one thing that's always bugged me about this movie, the first two times I watched it, I didn't understand the title. Because, you know, the demonstration is such a small part of the movie that it didn't click with me. And then it was one of those things where I wasn't thinking about it, and then suddenly some part of my brain went, you know, that's what it's talking about. I was like, oh, really? And it just never sat right with me. And one of the things Blaustein was saying is that right up until they were almost ready to release the film, they didn't have a title for it. And they were at a lunch with a bunch of the production people. And one guy said, well, what about the day the world stopped? And Blaustein took that and chewed on it for a while and tweaked it a bit and came up with The Day the Earth Stood Still. But that was never that wasn't the title of the film until almost the when it was released. And I think that's one of the few not so good things about the film is, you know, the titles, you know, it's synonymous with it being a classic now, but I really don't think the title suits the film.
Well, if it's any consolation, I've only just realized that as you've said it. It's only just occurred to me, of course that's what it's about.
That was like a forehead slap.
Yeah, and I kind of, what I'd actually rationalized it as being is everyone, it was a reference to everyone kind of going, oh! Which is
awful.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's kind of, the day everyone was really surprised, which would be a great title. The day we all kind of went, huh, it just doesn't work as well.
Or just things that make you go, shit.
Yeah. But the Day the Earth Stood Still, it's a nice dramatic title, that.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks great on the poster.
Well, the posters are fantastic, but they don't necessarily, they don't reflect the film. But then that was one thing. I didn't write this down, but when Gort is closing in on Patricia Neal and she's supposed to say the famous words, but she decides to stop and scream first. I don't know if that's just the way things were done back then, but her moment of panic seemed very calculated to me, and it's never felt true.
That whole concept of it seemed a little off to me, because after he'd made us repeat the words and it cut to the next scene, I found myself thinking, well, I've already forgotten what he said. so had he sent me, we'd be screwed. You know,
I've seen Army of Darkness too many times.
Yes, oh, yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Batu, Barata, Necron.
it would have been, hang on, I'm getting a pen. Hang on, what is it? How do you spell that? No, I'll write it phonetically. It's all right, because I'll never get it. And, you know, she just remembers it. So good on her for saving us all. I really enjoyed this film, you know, to sort of sum up, because we're coming to over an hour here. I really enjoyed this film and didn't expect to. So I can't give high enough praise to it for that reason alone. I think when you go into a film expecting to not enjoying, you kind of are destined to not enjoy it. But this was enough to slap me in the face and turn me around and go, no, look, this is actually quite good. And to find out, to just do a little bit more reading behind it and find out that it was directed by who it was directed by and the other films he'd done and stuff like that. This is a proper good legitimate film that you should see. Without a doubt. And then go and watch West Side Story, because that's awesome as well. I'd stay away from The Sound of Music, though. That's just me.
Yeah.
There are some people that will hate me for saying that. They're the people that go to the late night karaoke versions of that film, but, you know.
If The Sound of Music was about an hour shorter, I'd like it a lot more.
How long is it?
That's for sure.
It feels like about 4.5 hours. I don't know.
How long is it? An hour too long is how long it is.
Yeah.
But I agree with you on West Side Story, not just because I've performed in that show myself, but it's a good movie.
It certainly
is. I'll have to look into it then.
Oh, no. West Side Story is another one of those, you've got to have seen it. You don't necessarily have to enjoy it. You don't have to go out and buy it or watch it over and over again. But I think it's one of those people should have seen. Definitely. I think West Side Story, of all the films on his list here, it's possibly his most sort of, I don't want to say important, but no, that's a good word for it. It's a significant film, West Side Story. Without a doubt. My sister loves it. She is someone who's seen that over and over and over again, and will always continue to watch it, I think. But then she's a frustrated stage actress. Working in education.
Well, The Andromeda Strain was pretty good too, and also an hour too long.
Now, I've never seen that. I've never seen that. It's one of the. It's a Michael Crichton book, isn't it? But one of his earlier ones.
It's kind of hard to. It's kind of like 2001 in that it's very much a film of its time, and it's very, very slow moving. So by modern standards. It's kind of hard to sit through, but it's worth it.
Right. See, I think Michael Crichton books, when they're made into films, can go either way and be very, very good or be very, very bad.
Very, very true.
As witnessed by Jurassic Park being followed by Congo, I think.
Yeah. Congo is a terrible book. I made the mistake of reading it, and it's as bad a book as it was a movie.
I enjoyed the book, and I only say that because it's one of the few that I've read. So I can say that, but you know, and Timeline was a better book than a film.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, it's actually quite a good book and a god awful film, as I believe I might have mentioned before in the past. There are no night arrows in the book. There are no night arrows in the book. That was entirely Richard Donner's doing, I believe. Oh, well.
I went back and I listened to the Movies You Should See episode of Event Horizon after getting the movie, because I haven't seen the movie since the year after it came out. So I went back and watched the movie again just so I could listen to the episode that you guys did, just so I could hear the origin of Prepare the Night Arrows.
It's worth watching just for that scene, I think. But the two words that indicate how bad a film it is Paul Walker. Done.
Ooh.
That's my argument. That's all I have to say about that film. It's got Paul Walker in a lead role. What else do you want? Of course it's awful.
Well, Varsity Blues.
Is he in that?
Yes.
I haven't seen
But he gets injured,
that.
So he doesn't have much to do.
Oh, right. Okay.
I don't know if it's something you'd like now, but given when it came out and the age when I saw it, it's just one of those movies that, yeah, people 10 years from now might say how bad it is, but it resonates with me.
I've heard of it. Let me just bring it up. Oh, James Van Der Beek. I might have seen this, actually. I might well have seen that. It rings a bell. I was familiar with its existence, but I don't know 100% that I have actually sat through the whole film.
I mean, it definitely falls into guilty pleasure territory for me. I won't lie on that, but I don't know. I'd say that's maybe one of two good movies he's done.
Out of curiosity, what was the other one?
The Skulls?
Not heard of that one.
It was a straight, basically deals with the skulls and Harvard and secret societies and murders and Joshua Jackson.
I think the first one went to the theaters. The sequel was direct-to-video.
The two sequels were direct-to-video, yes.
Oh, there was a third one. Oh, see, that must have been after I stopped working at the video store.
I would watch this film. I'm looking at it on IMDb now. I would watch this film. It's got Shooter McGavin and...
Oh, yeah.
Loads of people in it. I'd sit through that. And do you know what? After watching Fringe, I'm quite a fan of Joshua Jackson as well. I've got more time for him than I did when he was in Dawson's Creek, which was just a blot on the 90s landscape as far as I was concerned back in the day. Why would I watch this? They're all so clean. It's nothing like real life. Nothing. Right. So shall we give this film a score out of 5? And
let's
do this. So, Rick, do you want to kick us off?
5. Absolute 5. Complete, unadulterated 5.
Cool. Scott?
Honestly, I hadn't even considered what score I was going to give it until about 5 minutes ago when I remembered we do scores for this. And, whatever I was going to say, I lost it. 5. Just jump right to it. 5. I was absolutely pleasantly surprised, and I was really impressed.
Matt?
I came into this fully expecting to give it a solid 3, but I think I'm going to have to bump it up into a solid 4.
Okay. I think I've sat here all the while thinking 4. But now you two guys have said 5. It's given me pause for thought. But I think I'm going to stick with 4.
Well, let me just run one sentence by you. There are a lot. It's something that Julian Blaustein said during his bit on the documentary. He said he's done a lot of films that have been called classics that he disagrees with, that he doesn't think they deserve to be called classics. He said this one does, and I agree with him.
I think you're right. You see, and I think it's because it's such a significant movie, especially in the genre of sci-fi, you know, that who am I to take a point off it, really? No, sod it, I'll go with 5. It's only a podcast, it doesn't matter. Which gives this film a score of 19, which I'm just checking might be the highest scoring film we've done since we brought this show back. Where is it? Movies You Should See ratings. Yeah, this is. That makes this the highest rated film. But to be perfectly honest, I don't have an issue with that. I think looking at the list of films we've talked about, this is genuinely more important and more significant than any of them. You know, it's certainly more important than the Avengers, which is the next closest one with a score of 18.
I don't think in 60 years people are going to still be talking about the Avengers.
Oh, that's another argument for another show. that's a heavy one there. But I kind of see your point. But
and I love the Avengers. Don't get me wrong. I'm not dissing it. But I don't think it was as groundbreaking as The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah, without a doubt. I can go with you on that 100%. I'm happy with that. I think that's good, and I think you're right. This is definitely a classic film. This should be on some. It probably is on many lists and things like that of films you should see. And what better film to talk about on a show called Movies You Should See?
So exactly.
Absolutely.
It's winning for now, definitely. Absolutely. So, guys, thank you ever so much for this show. It's flown by, which means it must have been good.
So, I had a great time.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming out and doing this. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Just to say to all our listeners, thank you for listening. And if you want to email in any suggestions, any feedback, any views about anything, our email address is moviesyoushouldsee@simplysyndicated.com, or just go to our webpage at simplysyndicated.com, and there's a little contact us button at the top of the page that'll just bring up a form you can fill in to send us an email. Go and do that. And if you want to listen to I always think it's 298 previous episodes, but it's so not that we did. They're all available as part of a Simply Everything subscription. If you go to simplysyndicated.com/everything, you'll see the page that will give you all the information about the streaming service that we've got. We do have an iOS app coming soon. It's 229 episodes. I managed to bring it up. And there's loads of movies, including the Event Horizon episode where I mentioned Night Arrows, which should be worth the listening. And so it helps us. That's how we run the network, you know. You pay us money, you listen to stuff. It's great. We make more of it. And shows like this get recorded. And it's brilliant. I'm really enjoying this. So thank you for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon with another show. And we'll catch you later. Bye-bye.